Thanks for joining us at Cults to Consciousness. This storytelling podcast is meant to be for entertainment purposes only and does not substitute for any medical advice. We may discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. Lastly, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the host.
There was a predator that was shuffled from one church to ours. I was one of the first people to find out. I went to the leadership in the church and school and was basically told that I was bitter and angry and resentful because I had an issue with them. And that if God forgave them, why can't I? Keep in mind, he had an active warrant for his arrest at the time he came to the school. We are an independent, fundamental, Bible-believing King James Baptist church. And it was just, we are the one and everyone else is getting it wrong. And so the superiority complex that was kind of bred into us was so strong. This is what it means to be a Christian, to be a man of God, to be a preacher boy, to be all of these things that you're supposed to be. But asking why you're supposed to be those things never came up.
Hey, my name is Shalise Ansola, and this is Cults to Consciousness, where we discuss leaving high-demand religions or organizations and finding healing and independence through awareness and true individual sovereignty. If you're only listening and you want to see our faces, you can go to our YouTube channel at Cults to Consciousness, where you can like, subscribe, become a supporter and advocate for these people bravely coming on and sharing their stories. This channel would not exist without them, so we love to give them that support and it boosts the algorithm. So today's guest, we actually connected months and months and months ago. I was supposed to be on his podcast, and then I was getting married, and it was too much going on. And then we reconnected, and I'm so glad that we did. We are blowing the lid off of the IFB, the Independent Fundamental Baptist. He was in the documentary on HBO, or I think they call it Max now, called Let Us Pray, P-R-E-Y, brilliant name. And it really just talks about how people, mostly these women, have been silenced with this abuse that was going on and how there was so much victim blaming. And he comes on as kind of an expert. He has his own podcast called Preacher Boys Podcast and YouTube channel. And so I'm really happy to get to talk to you today, Eric Skorzynski.
Yeah, so good to be here. Glad we made it happen.
Yeah, me too. So we really want to dive into your story, maybe in a way that you haven't done before yet. I don't know, maybe you have, because I'm sure you've been on lots of other podcasts, but everything that I've heard so far kind of just scrapes the surface. So I want to get deep into your childhood, what it was like being completely isolated within this group, because you said you went to school K through 12 at one of the IFB schools. You were at church 7 days a week, and your parents were even involved in some of the schools. And so you were really just completely involved and didn't have, I mean, maybe I'm putting words into your mouth, but didn't have a whole lot of exposure to the outside world. Would you say that's true or no?
Yeah, I would definitely say that's true. Especially like my early childhood was so isolated because I didn't have the freedom to really go walk somewhere by myself or go hang out with somebody the way that you would as a teenager. So especially early on, we were extremely fundamentalist. It was a lot more tight-knit. And everything that I did was either at my house, but more often was at the church, which was, you know, I would say like a second home, but I was there more than I was at my actual house. So like learning to ride bikes was at the church, hanging out with my best friend was at the church, like going to school, Sunday school, like everything was on that small campus in California.
Okay. There really was no separation between regular life and church life. Everything was completely interconnected, it sounds like. And that's how it is for a lot of these high demand religions. And that's why we call them high demand, because everything is so interwoven and there's really no way to split them up. It's like, this is your lifestyle. They tell you how to act, behave, think, what to do, what to dress, sometimes even what to eat. And everything is just part of this bigger picture, which is the IFB for you specifically. So for those who aren't familiar, maybe just give a little rundown or a brief overview of what it means to be in the IFB.
Yeah. So there's a lot of people who haven't heard of an Independent Fundamental Baptist church. So the easiest way I can go about explaining is looking at just what we know about church in general. So if you know about the typical church on the corner that has kind of a more old-fashioned style. If you take that and ratchet it up to 11, that was kind of our environment. So, you know, we didn't listen to music that had a beat in it. We wore suits and ties to church from the time I was a little kid on to the time I was a teenager. Women wore dresses that were always below the knee. We didn't go to movie theaters. We didn't drink alcohol. We didn't do anything that could be deemed outside the church, anything that would seem cultural. And one of the things that they waved around all the time was the Bible verse that says you're a peculiar people. And that essentially was the label that we try to live by. How do we live in a way that's weird to the world, but is right in the eyes of God, so to speak? And so, you know, think Footloose and you've got a pretty good estimation of where we were at.
It's so funny because I was about to ask you if there were any such thing as youth dances, especially if you can't have drum beats. Did you have any sort of dances or no? Off limits.
Dances were against the rules too.
Oh my gosh. So
dancing was wrong. Actually, the second time I ever danced, and I say that very loosely, was at my wedding. Up until then, I had never done anything like that. Like actually, the idea of dancing was sinful. Like there were so many things that were just not okay. And dancing was definitely high on the list.
Oh, that's so interesting. Because as someone who grew up where dance was my entire world, it was the only place that I felt like I could truly express myself and just be free and find myself. I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have that. And that's so, and I'm sure people who love music too, who just naturally want to move to music, could you even like do little grooves in your car, or were they just kind of like, hey, stop, don't do that?
Absolutely not. Yeah, I grew up honestly thinking I didn't like music for most of my life because the only thing we could really listen to was classical music, which look, there's some bops in the classical music world, but when it's all you're listening to, it gets a little bit old. And we could listen to like quartets and like trios and things. But again, like if you think of popular gospel groups like the Gaithers, we weren't even allowed to listen to them because they were too worldly. So like the Chris Tomlins, like Hillsong, like all that stuff was totally off limits, especially when I was a lot younger. To put in perspective, I got in trouble when I was a teenager for listening to Weezer. So it was a pretty strict environment for sure. To have any of that expression just wasn't okay. Emotionalism was really looked down upon, especially for men. And so music that generated an emotional response, like tapping your foot, moving your body, feeling any kind of emotion was very much looked down upon, except for altar calls where they wanted you to walk down and make a commitment. Then they amped it up a little bit.
Right. It seems like there's a lot of contradiction happening because I've seen some of the preaching from the pulpit and it is all theatrics. It is all about getting you to have an emotional response. But at the same time, put that away and don't show any emotion. Right. So was it, now that I'm saying it out loud, was it where you could have emotion and you were encouraged to have emotion in a church setting, but outside of that, you kind of had to shut it down?
Yeah. And they would have said that they weren't an emotional church. They would often point to churches that played kind of the softer, breathier worship music and say they ride on emotionalism. And like here, we're all about the Bible. But the difference really was the coat of paint we put on it. Like we would sing 12 verses of Just As I Am and encourage teenagers to go cry at the altar and make a decision for Jesus. But then we'd look down on people who just did that with different lighting or different aesthetics. And so it was very much an emotional thing. But yeah, emotions were contained to making decisions in the church context. There was a lot of manipulation, a lot of playing on your fears, a lot of playing on things that you were feeling strongly at the end of a service. But it was all to the benefit of the church. And it was never a healthy way to express the emotions. Mm-hmm. And I said recently on another show, when you talk about sales, one of the things they say is people buy things with emotion and justify with logic. And I feel like the decisions made in the church played out very much the same way. People would make decisions in these highly emotional environments and then justify that decision through apologetics later on.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it seems like the emotion that they use the most is fear. They tapped into your fear where you didn't want to be left behind. You didn't want to burn in hell. You wanted to make sure that you were with your family in the afterlife. Or I don't know if that was a thing. That was a thing for Mormonism.
Yeah.
But it seems like they really harped on this fear and got you in this fight or flight mode. And it's interesting that they would call out other churches. It seems like they have a way of redefining things to make you justify it. And a lot of cults do that. Like, we're peculiar people. We're supposed to be weird. So when someone comes up to you and is like, "You're so weird," you're like, "I know, isn't it great?"
Yeah, you're like, extra credit for me. Yeah,
they hide things in plain sight. Or, "We don't do that spiritual manipulation stuff like the church over there who's playing soft music." But at the same time, they are absolutely doing spiritual manipulation through fear and coercion. It's so interesting.
Right. And that's what's funny talking to someone like you who grew up in Mormonism, or talking to someone like an Alice Gretchen who grew up in the Pentecostal world. Like, the shades of it are different. Like, the aesthetic, like I said, is different. Mm-hmm. But then you start going, the tactics are all the same. Like, they're all going to the same playbook. They're just calling it different things.
Yeah.
It's the Holy Spirit here. It's this here. But ultimately, the goal is, how do we get you to make a decision that will benefit us as an organization and as a movement?
Yeah, definitely. Within Mormonism, I feel like the highlight emotion that they would use to manipulate would be not necessarily fear, more guilt and shame. Did you find that you had the same type of thing with yours, or was it mostly the fear?
They kind of played with each other. Like, guilt and shame and fear went hand in hand in, I mean, especially youth conferences and things that were heavily focused on teens, just the purity culture that was very strong in that environment. I know you can relate to that from the Mormon perspective as well. Like, they would, the first rule at every camp was, don't make purple, like, don't mix pink and blue. Like, that was like the go-to thing that they were most concerned about. And, you know, keeping 6 inches apart, like, women were taught that guys can't control their lust, and they're, you know, they're constantly going to trip up if you stumble them with what you're wearing. So, like, there was the shame of, hey, you're the one causing all of these major issues. But also there was the fear of, if you're doing that, you're leading people to hell and might be headed there yourself. Mm. And so that's a really toxic cocktail to grow up with, especially when you get into your teenage years and you are trying to figure out sexually what's going on. Like, mm-hmm. your body's changing, you're feeling all these things that are uncontrollable and natural. And then you're being told, like, if you have those thoughts, you're in big trouble. And I remember times as a teenager going to the altar in church and crying my eyes out, saying, "God, if I look at porn one more time, just take my eyesight, like, anything to make me stop doing this." And that's the kind of, like, heavy fear and shame and guilt where natural things become so suppressed that they explode in other areas that are really toxic and really unhealthy.
Yeah. And I'm glad that we can have your perspective on. We have spoken to women who have been victim blamed and shamed.
Right.
So I'd like to hear from your perspective what it was like as a young boy, as early as you can remember, getting those lessons and what that did to you. Because this patriarchal thing, this purity culture thing, it doesn't just hurt the women. It may affect them more. I don't know if that's even a fair statement, but it does also affect the boys and the men who are being told that they can't control themselves. So what kind of effect did it have on you?
Yeah. And I love that you raised that point, because it's something just recently I've started talking about more, is that I think because men on the outside look like they benefit from purity culture and patriarchal systems because they're not being outright abused in a very visible way, the teaching is just as harmful to men as it is to women. Mm-hmm. One may be being trained to be abused versus being the abuser, but there's a lot of teachings connected to it that are really negative toward men. Cutting off emotions is a huge one. A lot of the fear surrounding your sexual orientation is a huge one. The way that you're taught to view your wife as the replacement for whatever sexual urge that you have is, it's a really messy way to learn. And it's something that's taught to you from a very early age, both explicitly in what they teach from the pulpit and implicitly from what you're watching the leaders in your church do. Mm-hmm. And so growing up, I mean, just the conversation of modesty was something that was there from my earliest memory. You're seeing girls in your, you know, first grade class who are getting told, like, "Oh, your skirt's too short," or, "This is going to make people stumble." And wow. You're getting older and watching how these rules are just ramping up over and over and over again. And then the messaging that I was hearing from the pulpit constantly was, sex is amazing, don't have it. Guys are visual, you know, women are emotional, You know, men want to be respected, women want to be loved, like all of that cliche purity culture lingo that is just so untrue. Like my wife told me, she's like, the idea that only men are visual is just so stupid, you know, so stupid. But it's something that was told to us constantly. And really what you're being told is, as a man, you're an uncontrollable sexual monster.
Right.
And women are there to help satiate that need. And the one example I give all the time is, I remember telling my youth pastor, hey, I'm struggling with watching porn. And he said, well, soon you'll be able to get married and then you'll have your wife to use.
Oh, to use?
Right. And so that objectification was so layered in the language and so normalized, where if you go straight into marriage with that teaching, you're going to be, even if it's not you're trying to be, you're going to be an abusive husband because you've been taught that your wife is an object that's there for your use.
Yeah.
And that's, again, a recipe for disaster, which is a no brainer for anyone listening. But when you're growing up in it, this is just what you're told. Like this is the default teaching.
Yeah. And I'd like to get your perspective as well, as far as the modesty thing, because I feel like if you say, don't think of a purple elephant, purple elephant's the first thing that comes to your mind. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like it hypersexualizes these children in a way where they wouldn't have even considered it before. So I'm wondering if you remember as a young kid having those thoughts of, as soon as Susie got pointed out for not having a long enough skirt, are you now thinking about, oh, Susie doesn't have a long enough skirt. Oh, her legs are showing. Oh, you know, did you have any of that conflict where you felt like, looking back, you can see, oh, it was probably forced on me in a way that it never should have even crossed my mind?
Yeah. I mean, I've been toying around with doing some kind of article or episode just about how fundamentalism makes people extremely horny.
Because
it does. And it's something where, you know, growing up, there were things that were not sexual. I mean, first, let's back this all the way up. First, you've got adult male leaders telling female minors that they're going to cause people to stumble.
Yeah.
If you're looking at that equation, the person who's worried about being stumbled by a teenage girl is the problem. Let's remove them from the equation. Mm-hmm. Just as a common point of agreement there. When you look at other minors, like myself growing up, when you're around other people and you're taught about, very explicitly, about how great sex is, about how uncontrollable these urges are, about, you know, defeating the flesh and slaying the dragon inside of you, that's, you know, all that kind of stuff. Everything feels sexual. Mm. Like, to see a girl in pants when everyone I was around all the time was in skirts that were down below the knee and had to be long enough where if you sat down, they stayed below the knee and couldn't have more than a 2-finger length from their neck down to, you know, where their collar was, because you, God forbid, there be any sort of skin showing on the chest. Like, everything felt so explicit and so shocking. Mm. And so, you know, for me as a guy growing up in it, it's like, well, everything felt sexual in a world where nothing was supposed to feel sexual. And again, I think at a certain point, like, no matter what you cover someone up with, and we see this within strict Islamic culture, if you generate an environment that is heavily charged sexually and is repressing people in a very heavy way, you're going to see things happen that are negative and that run counter to what you're teaching. And so, you know, that teaching was just really toxic, and it made me feel just like I was, again, it makes you feel like you're going to explode because you're hiding all of this natural stuff way deep down. And it's like, you know what? It's kind of normal when you're a 15 or 16 year old to think about sex. But the teaching we got was, it's not normal until you're married, and don't think about it. Don't talk about it. Don't ask about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it puts you in a really, really weird position.
Definitely. Well said. I agree with all of that. And because we're rambling and this is fun and you're very smart, I'm like, let's dive into this a little bit deeper.
Let's keep swimming.
Because I've never really had this conversation before in depth, as far as what would you say to people who are saying, well, modesty is great and it's a respectful thing. And I agree that if you don't want to show your skin, you shouldn't have to. It's no one's forcing you to. It's the issue that I have is when people force you to be modest instead of allowing you to self-express the way that you want. So when you look at places like Europe, and they're very body positive, and I know that they don't rate their movies based on sex because sex is natural and normal. You get an R rating or something for violence because that's something that's not natural and normal. So when you look at this range of cover up to the point of hypersexuality versus showing everything, and maybe that would be considered, you're just desensitized. Mm-hmm. What would you say to people who would say, well, just showing your body and body positivity is just being desensitized? It's not actually healthy.
I think, honestly, I've just had the conversation with Alice Gretchen recently about this, and I really liked her perspective of the whole point of leaving this environment is that you don't have to do things you don't want to do anymore. And so her take on it was, if you want to cover up, cover up. If you don't want to, you don't have to. The point is, you don't have to do something that someone else is telling you to do anymore. Like, that's the point of freedom outside of one of these movements. When it comes to the conversation of modesty, this is something where you either have to have a law about it within your religious group or your society or whatever you want to label it, whatever organization you're in, or you have to admit that it's purely subjective in many ways. This does come down to personal preference, because what I think is quote unquote modest may differ from someone else. Mm-hmm. And modesty biblically is literally don't show off your wealth. If you want to get really technical,
interesting,
that's what those verses are about. But when it comes to modesty, I think one of the things that really opened my eyes to the truth about that conversation is going internationally. So when my wife and I went to India, which we can probably get into a little bit later, everyone in India, in the areas that we were in, has their stomach exposed. And that is it. And it's a very modest culture. India is right. A very, very modest world and very conservative in many ways. But women walk around in saris that show their stomach. And I told her, I said, isn't it interesting that here there's things that they cover up that they consider to be immodest? But if you see a girl in fundamentalist perspective where we grew up and she's exposing her stomach, we'd go, oh, she's slutty. Mm-hmm. Oh, she's this. But she's no more conservative than this person and vice versa. So it really is a cultural thing. And I do think the more that you stigmatize something and the more taboo you make something, the more you make that an issue versus just allowing it to be. Like, we all have bodies. I do think that there are some things that culturally we understand should be private or kept covered up, especially around kids and things in public. But I think overall, like, the conversation of legislating what's right to do with your body or what's a right way to express yourself is really a lame conversation, and it's all rooted in subjectivity.
Yeah, well said. I definitely agree with that. I just recently told this story about growing up in Utah, where the schools had very, very strict modesty rules, cap sleeves.
Is Utah conservative? Is it a pretty conservative place?
Well, at least when I was there, it was definitely all Mormon, or at least over 60% Mormon. And so
it's a weird place. Not to interrupt you, but whenever I go to Utah, I'm like, it's so weird to see, because you see it internationally in places like India, you know, where Hinduism is very much part of the culture.
Yeah.
But to go to Utah is like the only place I can think of in the United States where religion feels so core to the identity of the state itself. But anyway, not to interrupt you.
No, that's okay.
My thoughts about your own state.
But. Yeah, it very much is its own little bubble. And so all of the legislation and the rules around the school system and everything is basically just based on Mormonism. And so you have these modesty rules that they would get me in trouble for all the time. They would single me out in ways that I'm like, what about her? And they're like, but you're an example. It was the worst. But my point is, when I moved to Oregon for my senior year of high school and I asked the principal there, I'm like, what's the dress code? He looked at me so confused, was like, what are you even talking about? And I looked at my mom like, did I say something wrong? She's just like, I don't know. And he's like, just wear what you're comfortable in. And it just blew my mind, because girls came to school in shorts and tank tops and it was no big deal. And no one was stumbling. No one was distracted in school because her shoulders were showing. No one was hypersexualized and no one abused it. No one came to school in crop tops. Everyone was just wearing what they liked. And it was such an interesting experiment where I just realized, wait a second, it doesn't have to be this way, or there's another option aside from the modesty and the purity culture. It was very interesting. No teen pregnancies. People were on birth control. They actually knew about the reproductive system and how it worked. Yeah. And so, yeah, I just thank you for your opinion. I just wanted to get the side of a man who grew up in the very strict culture of purity culture.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's something that I definitely feel like is just coming up more and more. And I think it's because the more you get away from it, the more you realize how weird so many of these things were. And that subject of repression is one that I think is really fascinating because it has a opposite effect of what's intended by it.
Yes, absolutely. It always backfires and people don't see that. They're like, no, the more strict we are, the safer the kids are. No, it's actually very different. It's literally the exact opposite. And I've seen it time and time again on this channel when we interview someone who is from the most strict of strict cultures with their purity culture. I mean, you look at the Amish, in some cases, they weren't even allowed to know what pregnancy was. They weren't even allowed to know their mother was pregnant. They thought they were dying when they got their menstrual cycle because no one told them about bleeding. Right. They have the highest rates of abuse from what I've seen. And it just, yes, it backfires. So how did this translate to you in your teen years? I know you said you met your wife in high school, and I find that so interesting because you're not really allowed to date, are you? Or what was the culture where you were at?
I mean, I wasn't allowed to date. So we were just best friends for a couple of years. And yeah, I mean, dating was really looked down upon. The way that we were taught about dating was you date to marry, mm-hmm. which again, a lot of undue pressure on your 16-year-old brain is like, I really like this girl, but can I see myself marrying her?
Wow.
Which should not be on your mind. And so every conversation about dating was every date is a potential mate. Like that was kind of like the routine kind of statement they would make. And so there was a lot of gravity to those decisions. And so the way it played out practically was different depending on which kid you're talking to. Like some parents really pushed the courting thing where you don't go anywhere with this person. Like we kind of are here in the mix of it. And that's kind of where we fell into that range. It wasn't so weird as to say, hey, we picked this person for you to date, because that's a whole nother layer of horrible. We liked each other, and it was just kind of a supervised friendship that, you know, the day I graduated, I said, okay, now I can date you. Like, let's start dating. Up to that point, it was just, hey, we're best buddies here and we're going to hang out. And then I finally got permission to actually date when I graduated high school.
That must have been so hard as teenagers, especially because there was obviously a connection there. You're still together. You love each other. So did you find it hard to repress those romantic feelings and just stay friends for that long?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't repress them too much. Like, I think it was a pretty open secret that we liked each other. Again, the messaging was just so much pressure. Like, there was just so much pressure around, like, okay, well, you know, like they would throw out the verse, it's better to, I forget what the verse is, but basically get married because that's better than burning in your lust, you know? And
oh,
you're
wow.
in, you know, you're finishing high school and you're like, it's burning, you know, like we got to hurry this up. And, you know, it's just so much pressure to like go to the next step, but also being constantly held back going like, not yet though, because you have to be this, this, and this. And so it was just constantly pressure from all sides of like, some leaders are saying, don't date. Some are saying, hurry up and get married. Some are saying, I wish you'd get married right now. Like, but there was really not a lot of just helpful advice of like, hey, focus on being a kid right now, mm-hmm. or hey, focus on doing this, or hey, this doesn't have as much weight as you feel like it has right now. And so it was just a big crock pot of just different opinions and ideas that are all kind of hitting you at the same time and feels like conflicting advice about hurry up, slow down, all of those things, plus the mix of just normal teenager like anxiety and all those things that are already there. Everything's dialed up to 11. Like that's the best way I can explain everything in that world is the normal teen angst that you have, dial it up to 11. The normal shame and awkwardness that you feel, dial it to 11. The overstepping, you know, leadership around you, dial it to 11. And that's really the environment that we were cultivating a relationship in.
Mm-hmm. So I know that women often get the message from young, young girls, your whole purpose is to find your person and get married and have the kids and all of that. Did you get the same sort of messaging when you met your wife in school? Were you thinking, okay, this is my wife, I figured it out?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of midway in that direction. So my mom was always a little bit, she always pushed back a little bit about that kind of mentality. She was like, women can have jobs, and like very progressive thoughts like
that.
Yay,
mom.
Actually, when I met my wife, she was a lot more inspired by like the stay-at-home daughter movement of that world, which I know Ashley Easter, I'm sure she's talked to you about that.
Yeah.
Her perspective was very much at the time, very anti-feminist, very, so like she kind of pulled me more that direction early on. And going into our relationship, like the conversations were like, we're going to have a bunch of kids, as many as we can possibly have, you know, we're going to be, you know, all those things that like you naively say before you've even had a real relationship.
Yeah.
But you're just looking at these role models who, again, you're learning both explicitly and implicitly, like you're supposed to have a quiver full of kids. You're supposed to, the guy's going to go work and provide for all those kids. And the wife is going to stay home and homeschool them all and, you know, be barefoot pregnant in the kitchen all the time. Like, that was the messaging that we were getting from our leadership constantly.
Oh my goodness. Having been pregnant for a long time now, 37 weeks, I just have a whole new perspective on these quiverfuls of kids and right. having...
Let's put this on loop. Let's keep doing this over and over again.
I'm like dying over here. How could anyone have so many children? Just new respect for all the women who have 5+ kids. It's just, it's a lot. And I know pregnancy is different for everybody, but still, I'm just thinking how.
But it's not that different to where it's not a breeze for anybody to be like, yeah, 18, 19, let's keep going. You know?
No, thanks. I just can't even imagine that. So are there any other standout moments from your childhood? I do actually, you know what, let's go back and talk more specifically about the school and the environment and what you're learning and what the atmosphere is like, because it was very specifically an IFB school, right?
Yes. I mean, as far as our education, and I know you mentioned, but I went to school Monday through Friday, like a normal school. And that was the same school and same building from the time I was in kindergarten to the time I was a senior in high school. The school from that entire range ranged about 180 people on average through that time. So literally I started in kindergarten at like one end of the school, and like each year you just switch classrooms in your,
wow,
your senior year. And so our teaching in the school 5 days a week was very similar to our teaching in the same building at church, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. And then Saturday mornings, I was going to the church and going out and inviting people to the church in school. So like my life was revolved around this belief system and this teaching. Our teaching in the school was, versus some people I've talked to, I got a pretty good education in terms of I know how to read and write, which I can't say for a lot of people that grew up in the same type of environment. A lot of them did the do it at your own pace, you know, kind of curriculum. They really struggle with a lot of things that are just foundational academic pieces. That part was good for me. I can write well, I can read well, like I didn't get shorted there. The things that we were taught that are maybe odd to listeners of this show is, you know, things like science. We were taught that, you know, evolution is like this demonic theory and that the world was created in 7 literal days. The earth is 6,000 years old. We would watch all of the Ken Ham, you know, Ark Encounter type videos. Science was kind of a, you know, here's your basic science, but then like, here's where the Bible overrules the things that science would tell you. And so I feel like there's a lot of gaps there in my understanding. In sex ed, there was none. So there's a lot of gaps there. There was actually a few things that like doing this show 3 years ago, I would be like, oh, that's not true.
Really?
Here's one good science example. One of the things that we were always taught as a proof of the creation story in Genesis was God took Adam's rib and made Eve. And so Eve was made from Adam's rib. So we were taught by several people that came through that men have one less rib than women do.
Oh.
Because, and I've talked to people who are nurses who found this out in nursing school, who grew up in the same environment. I believed even up till recently that that was just a fact. That was kind of weird. And they explained it with the Bible. That's not true. You know, like,
surprise.
Just in case anyone doesn't know, you know, the idea of losing your virginity, all the things we were taught about, like, oh, the doc, you know, if you use a tampon, you're going to lose your virginity. Like, all that right. kind of stuff was so regular. There were things like that I just took in. I'm still to this day picking out things that I'll hear. I'm like, oh, that was just not true. That was like mm-hmm. literally their theory about this or their control mechanism here. And then the other lacking part was really the fact that when it came to history and philosophy and science, there was no counter opinions to anything they taught. So like the idea of watching a debate was not a thing. The idea of learning like, hey, here's what someone else thinks the Bible means. Or here is a different, it was no, we read the King James Bible. This is our translation. This is the inspired, preserved word of God. The people that are using the ESV, the NIV, they don't have the Bible. That's how narrow this road was. And so education-wise, I would just say, while there were many positives in terms of grammar and like the basic things that I'm thankful I got that many didn't, when it came to learning how to think, how to consume information, process it, and make a decision accordingly, I don't feel like I was really taught that skill until, you know, except for like, again, through my mom in like the later part of high school where she would start doing that. But even then there were some things politically, there was just, it's a given. You're going to be this, you're a Republican, you're this. Like there was still things that were just nailed in. Like this is what it means to be a Christian, to be a man of God, to be a preacher boy, to be all of these things that you're supposed to be. But asking why you're supposed to be those things never came up.
Yeah. It sounds like they did not teach critical thought
no.
or allow you to question things or even just push back at all. And I'm wondering, because you mentioned they would say, oh, other churches use spiritual manipulation, but you still didn't really know what other churches believed. How would they bring up other churches in that context of we have the right way and they don't?
I mean, other churches were just sermon examples. It was, you know, the Catholic Church and their sexual abuse, and the Catholic Church doesn't let people read the Bible. And there were two towns where I grew up and they were right next to each other. So it felt like one town. They should have just merged. But there was a church right in the next town about 10 minutes from us. And they would play more of like the Casting Crowns, Chris Tom, like Christian rock that you'd hear on the radio. And, you know, they would wear jeans. Like they were very progressive in that way. And looking back, it's funny because they were very conservative in many ways.
Yeah.
But the way that we would hear about them from the pulpit, they wouldn't name the church. They would just say, hey, that skater church down the road.
Oh.
Like if another church was brought up, it was always just to slam them for not doing it the right way. And it was very much, we are an independent, fundamental, Bible-believing, King James Baptist church. And it was just, we are the one and everyone else is getting it wrong. Mm. And so the superiority complex that was kind of bred into us was so strong. And, you know, my wife loves showing me my Facebook memories from like that time period. Because there was stuff I wrote that was just ridiculous about, you know, I'm walking down the street in my suit and I look over and I see someone dressed this way and I just feel so burdened for them. And it's like, it was so like self-aggrandizing, like, oh, I'm the best thing that ever walked the earth. Because that's what we were taught is like, we have the truth and no one else does. And man, shame for them. Like, let's go knock on their door and leave a tract and hopefully they'll become one of us. You know, that was the mindset. 24/7.
That's so similar to Mormonism. There's actually a lot of similarities, which I find interesting. So we could listen to music, but they always tried to limit it. Make sure you're not listening to music that's swearing or has bad language in it or suggestive things in it as far as sex goes. And then we weren't allowed to wear anything but suits and ties to Sunday school and to church. And for women, you had to be in a dress. In fact, when they had this whole movement for, I think it was called Ordained Women, led by Kate Kelly, I believe, the rebellious thing was to wear pants to church as a woman. And it was like, how dare you come to church in pants? And I don't think anyone was going in jeans. They're probably going in slacks or something that was still nice.
Like the Hillary Clinton pantsuit is so egregious, you know.
Just could not believe it. But in regular life, you could wear jeans if you wanted. So it's interesting where there's the crossover.
Yeah, we couldn't do that in regular life either.
Really? Yeah. So you had to wear suits all the time?
No, suits, guys got a little more leeway as they always do in religion. And we got to wear, we could wear jeans and like polos or t-shirts. Like it was pretty loose rules there, you know, depending where you were at and depending who was your leader. Like, you know, if you wore like too bright a color as a guy, they'd kind of come shame you a little bit. But for girls, it was always skirts everywhere. Even going swimming, like you're wearing skirts or culottes because you can't wear bathing suits. Like,
oh my gosh,
it was strict all the time. Yeah. Like the Mormon crossover, it's so funny because one of my close friends is a former Mormon. And like, there's so many things that are like right here. Like you can almost do a perfect Venn diagram of the rules.
Yeah.
But then there's like little weird things. We were allowed to drink energy drinks, you know, thank God for that. but like, then he talks, he's like, man, that was like the biggest deal. When I started drinking Monster, was like, oh no. Yeah. So it's just funny, the things that were like so important, even though, you know, at the end, all of us looking at back go, none of this was important. Like we were just debating these arbitrary rules.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's a cultural thing as well. The rules shift and change depending on where you're at. Because I remember, I am pretty sure that Mormons in Utah think energy drinks are just fine and they will do pre-workouts and they're like all about fitness.
Really?
It's a really weird fitness culture in Utah where it's so intense and odd. Even in LA, you don't see people that crazy about, anyways, it's this whole culture there.
Again, repression. Yeah, it's going to come out somewhere.
Don't even think about coffee. Yeah.
And you can't even do hot drinks, right? You can't do like hot tea and stuff like
that. So that's where the rule comes from. It's called the Word of Wisdom that Joseph Smith made up. And he's like, this is the way to be healthy. And he literally just says hot drinks. And then they decided that it meant coffee and tea. But then they're like, well, herbal tea's fine, but nothing with caffeine in it. So does that mean we can't drink soda with caffeine? And most people would say, yes, that's against the rules. But then you have people drinking energy drinks and doing hard prescription drugs from their doctor, which are fine. Because my mom got in trouble for drinking coffee. And she's like, yeah, but what about these pain pills, this Oxy that I got for my back surgery? And he's like, oh, but that's fine. She's like, I could literally die from these, but I can't have coffee for my digestion. And it was just this, none of it makes any sense.
That would do really well in Hemet, California. Like you can do Oxy, but you can't do coffee. They'd Jeez. Be like, yeah, sign me up.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, none of it really makes sense. So we got kind of an overview of the school environment, what you were growing up in. Church seemed like 24/7. Did they also inject religious studies in your everyday school?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So
I can expound on that.
Yeah, please do.
Yes. A great podcast guest adds information. I'm just going to simply say yes. Yeah, no, it was injected in everything. I mean, in science, history, I mean, the way, and you can find examples online, like there was a lot in our education where, you know, say you're talking about slavery, you know, which I know the Mormon Church has a spotless track record when it comes to racism. But in our denomination, you know, there was a lot of racial things that came into play within our teaching. And perspective wise, there were some groups within the IFB that were hardcore racist. I would say like it was a light undercurrent in some of our stuff, which so it was better by comparison, but still pretty bad. But it would be simple things like they'd be talking about slavery in a history book, but they would always add a section there about some slave owners were, you know, believed the Bible when it said to treat your slave with respect and dignity. And some slaves even loved their owners, you know, which again, someone who's listening who has no context is like, what the heck?
Ooh.
But it was things like that where it would either brush over something that was like of extreme significance and say like, oh, well, this wasn't as bad. It was very much like that Christian right-wing ideology was layered in there. You know, in things like science, you know, like it would include a lot of things that say, we know because of this, that this is the case. But like the reason that we know is just the Bible said so.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just layered in with everything. And even in math and things like, you'd get sections where math is important because it shows us that God is a God of order. Like it was just the undercurrent for everything that we did.
Right.
Like the only things that really strayed away were like spelling. Yeah, there might be some Bible words or something. Everything was always like, hey, there's this deeper spiritual purpose for this. And everything reflects God in some way. And There was nothing outside that default operating system that really existed for us. It was all the time, there's some level of like God and country wrapped in here, you know?
Yeah. So every subject pretty much had religion enmeshed. But did you also have classes where it's like, in this class, we are talking about this book of the Bible, where it's specifically religion-based?
Yeah, Bible class. We had Bible class every Bible morning. We had Bible class every morning to start the day. So every day typically started with you stand up in class, you pledge the American flag, you pledge the Christian flag, you pledge the Bible. And then you, on Wednesdays, we'd have chapel. So we'd have a guest speaker or like someone from the staff that would do like a chapel service with us. And so, yeah, it was very much a core piece of our, you know, I mean, even in sports, like we had the Christian Character Award, you know, which I was proud to win a few times. So I wasn't winning MVP. So it was like, it was just, we started and ended everything with that. But yeah, I mean, literally every morning was you pledge allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance to the Christian flag, pledge allegiance to the Bible. We, you know, open our Bibles to whatever we're reading, usually something in Proverbs where they'd have a wisdom principle or something. And that's kind of how we'd start our day.
Okay. I don't know if I'm the only one here or if it's because I grew up in a cult. I had no idea that Christians had their own flag.
What?
I really did. Yeah. I'm like, am I alone here? Guys in the comments, let me know. I'm like, wait, there's a Christian flag?
Yeah, there's a Christian flag. And I'll see if I can find a picture. And then it has its own pledge. And then the Bible had its own pledge. Because we all know the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag. Yeah. And then the Christian flag was, I pledge allegiance to the Christian flag and to the Savior for his kingdom it stands. One Savior crucified, risen and coming again with life and liberty for all who believe. And then the Bible was, I pledge allegiance to the Bible, God's holy word. I forget the rest of it. I'm sorry. I did it every day for years. What? And it's gone.
I feel like it's just a ripoff of the regular Pledge of Allegiance.
Yeah. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. I will hide God's word in my heart that I might not sin against thee. That was the
okay
pledge. Yeah, there's the Christian flag right there.
Oh, okay. So that does look familiar.
Yeah, you've probably seen it. And it would fly like in front of most IFB churches. It flies right underneath the American flag on their flagpole. Okay. But see, that's the little weird stuff that like, yeah, you know, the Christian flag. And then I talk to people and they're like, the what? So it's always interesting what jumps out. But yeah, we pledged all three every day. I'm not singing my alma mater, but that was also interesting. But
okay, I learned something new today. Thanks for that. So let's move on past your schooling now. You went to Bible college for a year.
No.
Oh, right. You signed up, but then you left to go work overseas.
Boom. Yeah. So I signed up for Bible college. I really did not want to go to Bible college because from the time you mentioned expression through dance, like my expression was getting behind the camera and filming videos. Like that was the way that I did stuff. And so from the time I was like probably my daughter's age, like 6 or 7. And so I grew up using cameras. Like that was my way of doing it. And I wanted to go to a school where I could learn how to do that professionally. And the options in the independent Baptist world as far as college was pretty limited. There was Bob Jones University, which I'm sure you've probably heard of. They're a pretty well-known college. Mm-hmm. They had a production arm, which was interesting to me. There was Maranatha Baptist that had like some level of similar thing. It was not as big a program as BJU. I picked West Coast Baptist College in Lancaster because it was 2 hours from where my now wife was. So I was like, I'll pick one close. I'll do 1 year of Bible to get everyone off my back. And then I will leave that and go do what I'm going to do. And I got a call about 3 months before I was supposed to go to college. I was just about to graduate. And it was from somebody I had met previously who offered me an internship that started off with shooting a documentary film in India. And he's like, do you want to go to Bible college in the middle of the desert that you don't want to go to? Or do you want to go to India and then travel around and shoot videos? And I was like, the second one that you just said.
Yeah.
And so I had a meeting with my pastor and with my dad that was very long and very miserable, where he basically was in front of me telling my dad, like, how are you going to let your son do this? if I brought 100 pastors in here, 99 of them would say he needs to go to Bible college. Like, this is a big mistake. Anyway, I eventually got the green light very reticently. I decided as an 18-year-old to go move to Fresno. I was on a plane to India, shot a documentary, came back, and I ended up interning for about 2 years, traveling to churches in about 13 different states, three different countries, doing promotional videos for churches like all over the place. And so I say to this day, even though some of the clientele we had, I wouldn't endorse, the experience was, I mean, invaluable. And I got to travel a bunch and I got to see a lot of different cool places and learn with hands-on experience. So it was a way better time than Bible college. So I'm glad I made that decision.
That sounds incredible. Honestly, it sounds like, especially in the position you were in, that you were living the dream because you were still doing something for God. You were still pursuing a passion and you got to see the world. What I want to know, because it's true for me and I think for a lot of people, that once you are plucked out of your environment and you actually see other cultures, you start to question, or people start to question you. Was your faith shaken at all by seeing the world?
My faith was shaken near the tail end of high school. And I won't go into the full version of the story because I've shared it a million times, but the short version is there was a predator that was shuffled from one church to ours. I was one of the first people to find out. I went to the leadership in the church and school and was basically told that I was bitter and angry and resentful because I had an issue with them, and that if God forgave them, why can't I? And keep in mind, he had an active warrant for his arrest at the time he came to the school, and like ended up pleading no contest, and it was a big mess. I am still convinced I was right about that situation. I think any rational person would. Seeing that abuse could happen in our denomination was a big bubble bursting moment for me. And it had me questioning the denomination I was in. So when I went to the internship, I was at a spot where I really didn't know what I believed. And I didn't really know. I just knew there was something wrong with what I grew up in and took for granted all those years. And so I was kind of on a mission to figure out what I believed about the Bible. Really, deconstruction wasn't really as buzzy a word then, but I was kind of, I just told people, I was like, I'm kind of kicking away at the floorboards to see what stands on, to scrutiny, and what was just preference stuff. And so for those 2 years, traveling did help with that, because especially international travel, like if you have a hard stance on something, go travel to another country and realize how little your stance matters when you start going to other cultures. But getting around other people, like actually meeting real Muslims in real life and real Hindus in real life, and meeting people who are actually persecuted in, you know, communist countries and have had their faith actually tested versus you. And then, you know, seeing a lot of independent Baptist churches who are a lot of the clients, like seeing the same weird hangups that some had that others didn't, and meeting some real jerks that I used to look up to, and meeting some people I thought were jerks that were nice guys. Like, I got a lot of perspective, and, you know, it was a messy period of time, but it really helped me kind of keep sharpening away at what do I actually believe about the world that I see around me. And I by no means wrapped up that journey after that 2 years, but it drew me a lot closer to, you know, having clarity about like, what do I believe versus what was just put into me to, again, default operating system, believe this.
Right. And were you married at the time then, you said?
No, I wasn't married yet. I got married. So the timeline from that point on was, one of the clients that we worked with was a missions organization. That's why I went international to three different countries. I fell in love with that work, and especially the orphanage that they had operating. And I quit my internship at the end of the 2 year mark and went to go work with them. During that time frame, about a year into working with them, I got married to my wife. And we got married. And then about 2 weeks after we got married, we were on a plane to go to India, where we planned to live for at least a year.
Okay. And so, just to make sure I understand correctly, this was with a separate organization that was not IFB related.
They were IFB adjacent. So the guy that was in it, like a lot of our supporters were IFB. The guy who ran it was kind of, he was on that slippery slope out, you know, like he was, it was a weird spot. Like, we were both so connected. Our supporters, a lot of them were IFB churches, but we were all kind of in our group of leadership within the organization going like, hey, it's pretty dumb to require people to wear ties. Hey, I think guys can have beards. Hey, I think, you know, if you're in India and they play drums, they're not going to hell. Like, there was like little things like that, that were like Bible translations, like the Calvinists, like there was a lot of things that we were just kind of moving the goalposts a little bit and becoming more evangelical personally. While our supporters, a lot of them were like big names in the IFB world. One of those IFB churches literally dropped the support of us and the orphanage because they saw a picture of us in India without ties during a service. So like, it was like this fracturing that was kind of happening.
Yeah. Kind
of slowly.
And it sounds like your eyes are being opened from all the travel and you're going, does that really matter? Yeah. Does it matter if I have a necktie on? That seems a little silly.
It's 130 degrees in India. Do I want to wear a tie? No.
Yeah. So you and your wife, did she feel the same way? Did she feel like, oh, maybe I can relax on this. Maybe I don't need 10 children. What were her thoughts? If you don't mind sharing, I know it's her story, but.
Yeah. Yeah. And hey, I don't think she'd mind me sharing this. We were both, I feel like, in a pretty healthy spot at that point where we were both religious, but we're starting to get a grasp on some reality of like how things work and like starting like, hey, now we're not talking about marriage in theory, like we are. And now we're not talking about ministry in theory, like we're doing it. So, you know, we still had some things, like we were still very influenced by a lot of like the patriarchal teaching and like all that kind of stuff. But I feel like even then, and my wife laughs now because like, I, you know, I'll say stuff like, oh, I'm so different now on this, or I'm, and she's like, well, you've always kind of questioned the system. You're just questioning more and more of it now. We would question things and have conversations. It was not a thing of like, hey, I'm making the decision, fall in line, woman kind of thing. Like, and it wasn't for her like, oh, I don't know, this is what they taught us. Like, we were having really, I think, as intelligent as a conversation as people in their young 20s can have about why we're doing the things we're doing. So I think we left in a semi-good spot, though there was still a lot of indoctrination that was still very deeply rooted in us.
Yeah, that seems fairly rare, actually, for a man to not wholeheartedly want to step into that patriarchal role, especially because that's what he's been groomed to do, is to be the leader and to be like, no, you're going to listen to me, but to actually value your wife's opinion and for her to want to have an opinion. I think that's pretty amazing that you were able to both sort of transition out together, because it happens so often within mixed faith marriages where one person's on board and the other one's like, no, this isn't what I signed up for. And then they fall apart.
Yeah. Yeah. And by no means do I want to give the illusion that I was like perfect early on. There were still things, I think, as a result of the teaching and as a result of being a young dude, where like there were times I discounted emotions that she was expressing. Mm-hmm. And there were times I was an absolute asshole, you know, like there were things that, again, you're taught and trained to be that way, but also you don't have an excuse. I've kind of come to a spot with that when it comes to like ownership of behavior, where it goes, your upbringing can explain the way you feel and the way you behave, but it doesn't justify it.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of things, you know, like when we first got to India, you know, it was her first time leaving the country at all, which culture shock. And, you know, I remember her crying and being emotional about being there. And I was like, well, this is what you thought God wanted you to do. We're here. It totally bypassed the emotion that she was rightfully feeling as a young girl who's out of the country with this guy she just married, even though we'd known each other. Again, that was the response that I think was normal in our environment, but it wasn't okay. Mm. And so, you know, as healthy as we were, I don't want to give the illusion that we were perfect. And I also don't want to give the illusion that like there wasn't a lot of work to be done and that there still isn't, because that stuff, again, when you're idling and your default operating system tells you to act a certain way, you have to consciously counteract that. And that's very exhausting, hard work, but it has to be done.
It's really awesome that you're able to take that accountability and to let everyone know, well, I wasn't perfect, because that does take a lot to even admit to. So I appreciate that. And I also have to second the whole default program system, because I know for me, things will still pop up and I'm like, wait, is that what I really think? Or was I just programmed to believe that way? And that's why this show is called Cults to Consciousness, because you literally have to be conscious. You have to become aware of your thoughts and your feelings if you want to shift into a healthier space, a healthier way of thinking, a more peaceful way of being. And so that's great that you could admit to that, because it's hard to do, and you said it, it's hard work. And that's why a lot of times people don't deconstruct, because it's a lot of work to actually do that, that deprogramming, and to figure out a new baseline that is healthy for you. So I know you wanted to talk a little bit, well, I want to talk a little bit about this organization, because you said even within this next organization, you kind of left one cult and found yourself in another problematic place. So whatever you want to say about that.
I mean, basically, like I mentioned, the guy had who was running it had been IFB, and really hadn't left any of the functionality of the IFB. He just slapped a new coat of paint. It was a little bit cooler, a little bit hipper, a little bit sexier. Like, we're not like them. But really, the way it operated, the way that he ran things, was very much the same way. Very manipulative. I think when I started, I was making $300 a month doing social media management, which is not a lot of money to be doing social media management, even if you're doing like a post a week. Like, that's not that much money. I was doing all of their social media management and working on emails and like jumping on calls. Like, it was very much my job. And by the time I was about to get married, I was making about $500 a month, which is almost twice what I was making, and still about a fourth of what I probably should have been making as an intern. And on top of that, like, I would randomly be traveling with them. I was doing a lot of work. And so near the time I was getting married, probably about 2 months out, I sent a message to the guy who was running the organization and said, hey, I'm about to get married. $500 is not a lot of money. I'd like to be making enough where, like, I'm not panicking. Really, at that point, our plan was to go to India. Our expenses would be paid while we're there. And legitimately, where we were going, I didn't need that much more to be able to pay for our expenses, because our housing was going to be covered, because we were going to live at the property. And like, most of our food would be there at the property. Like, I was just needing money where, like, hey, if something happens, I have options. Like, I have money here, you know, normal adult things. The message he sent back to me, and I wish I had pulled it up, but it said almost verbatim this. It said, I could take this burden away from you, but I'd be robbing you of seeing God do something miraculous.
Oh my gosh.
That was like almost, I may have like one word wrong in that, but like, that was what he said, was, I could take this burden from you, but I'd be robbing you of seeing God do this miracle for you. You know, at the time, I was still in this spot where I was like, you know, like, it was this tying back into the shame, the fear, the insecurity of religion. All that I thought in those moments was, man, I wish I had that kind of faith. Yes, I had anxiety still, like, oh man, that's not what I was hoping for. But it wasn't enough. Like, if I got that text now, I'd be like, hey, fuck you, bro. Like, Venmo me some money. I've been doing a lot of work. You know, but at the moment, there's still that part of me that's like, well, he's living by faith. He went out, like, he went and left the country. Like, he raised support. Like, maybe it is something I need to, like, see God do something big. And the conversation ended there, you know, which again, I think shows, like, as much as I was learning to be a rational thinker, I wasn't fully yet. And we got married. I was, you know, I was making $500 a month. We had about $3,000 when we got married, and that's including our honeymoon fund. So we went and did some stuff and ran. The strategy was, by the time we get on the plane to go to India, we should be out of the money we have, but then we'll be in the safety net of having our support when we get there.
Yeah.
It was $500 a month still when we got there. We go to India. We're there for like 4 months. We were supposed to be there for a year. We ended up having to come home, and then we're kind of lost in this flurry of, what are we going to do? That's when our pay got raised to $1,000 a month, and we went to go live by the home church that had sent the organization out.
Yeah. Something that you had mentioned on the phone was, while you're getting $500 a month, he is living lavishly. And living in the opposite way.
Yeah, he was living in this epic apartment in the Dominican Republic that I visited. And I was like, wow, this place is amazing. It's like this penthouse, like a huge view of this. And my American Christian brain was like, it's amazing how affordable things are here, that he got this amazing, amazing apartment. Uh-huh. And that's how I just thought of it, was like, man, he's probably not, he's probably spending a couple hundred bucks and getting like what would be $1 million place here in the States. Anyway, what ended up coming out was, while he was paying me $500 a month and trying not to rob miracles from me, he was paying himself a six-figure salary on top of covering his own expenses through ministry funds. And on top of that, was also using ministry funds as basically his personal checking account for meals and all sorts of things, raking in a good 13, 14 grand every month toward his own lifestyle while I was struggling and sitting there, you know, trying to make things work. He was not, but he was preaching a message of live sacrificially, give your all to God, and God will take care of you. And I think that's easier to preach when you're really taking care of yourself through ministry funds.
I was going to say, God seemed to be taking care of him, but he just wasn't sharing the wealth, right? He wasn't.
Exactly.
That's the funny thing when people say, well, like he was saying, let God do these miracles. And in my head, I'm like, well, God has given you the means to be the vessel to do miracles. So isn't that your job?
Please.
Yeah. Anyway. So, was that one of the things that you found out that kind of broke your shelf, or did you not find that out till later?
I found that out after we came back from India. So when we got back from India and went to Virginia, we ended up finding out very quickly, hey, there's this mess that's happening. We need to talk about it. And that's when we realized, like, basically there was no way to even know how much money he'd taken out. Cause like usually thieves aren't the best bookkeepers anyway. And it was a mess. And it ended up leading to like a complete rebrand of the organization. The original one had to be shut down. Like, there was no way to move forward with the way it was. Basically, our timeline from there, though, like, we were in Virginia for 3 months and Trump was running for office. And the church was doing some weird stuff, like praying around the American flag for our candidates, but it was clear which one. And I just said, hey, I think we're going to go to a different church. And the response to that was, you know, you should probably not work at this organization anymore and leave the state. And so we hopped on a plane with $1,000 in our bank account and moved back to California. And that was my last time really formally being part of a church in a real way. Mm-hmm. We would go to church here and there, but like, it's basically the moment where I went like, okay, in high school, I realized the IFB is broken. That was confirmed more and more and more. Now I'm realizing like the corporate church in America is really broken. And none of the religions that I'm experiencing reflect the Jesus that I believe I know and the Jesus that I believe I'm reading about. And so I feel like a person without a home religiously. And that's really, that last experience is what really pushed me into that isolation mode, to where it's like, I got to figure this out, because the American church seems really messed up. And the way that we're doing things seems messed up, and it seems to run counter to everything I believe would be appealing about this savior that we are supposed to be serving. And really from that point on, I think that was 2017, on to now, has been an experience of kind of trying to navigate, like, what do I believe about all of this, mm-hmm. which you could do a whole podcast about cults to consciousness.
Yeah, the deconstruction part of, if that's not true, is any of it true? And I think that was the statement that summed up me leaving Mormonism, where I was like, wait, is Jesus even a thing? Do I want to believe in Jesus? Do I want to remain Christian? I mean, it's just so much to think about, especially all at once, when your entire framework collapses on top of you and you're just sitting there in the rubble going, which pieces do I want to handpick out? Do I just get rid of all of it and start from scratch? It's just so hard to find your footing when your entire life has been wrapped up in it, especially like you've been talking about, your whole life up until that point was completely integrated in this church. So did you travel to a bunch of different churches? Were you both trying to kind of settle on something that felt right? Did you just say, no, I'm just going to chill for a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, after we left Virginia, I wasn't eager to join anything. And it's a lot. I mean, again, I talk about all that very succinctly now, but it was pretty traumatizing going from, I mean, getting married, leaving the country. We expect to be there for a year. We get shaken up and leave 4 months early. We're going to Virginia, like, suddenly. We're there for 3 months. Unexpectedly, that comes to an end. I lose my job. In tandem with that, I come back to California. We have nowhere to live. We're just around family. We couldn't afford plane tickets to come home from Virginia. Like, it was like, we're leaving. We're not taking anything. Like, we took, like, our bags and got on a plane. And so, you know, we would go to, like, her family's church that we used to go to here and there growing up. It was very much just, what are we doing? Like, it doesn't feel right. And all of the dialogue I was having with people in the church, even, like, the well-intentioned people, all they wanted to know was, are you mad at God? You're not mad at God, are you? And it's like, I don't know what I feel. Like, I just want people to be there and support. But instead, I'm just getting, like, you're still going to be a soldier in the Lord's army, you know, like, you're still going to keep cranking along. And it's like, I don't feel like we should be. I feel like this is time to heal.
Yeah.
But no one gives you that time. And so, you know, yeah, we went here and there to church, but it really, I mean, especially me, I was just like, I'm done. I just can't do this anymore. And yeah, just kind of took a break and still on that break, I guess, technically.
Yeah, so. Which is fine. If that's what works for you, then great. Because people come on with lots of different consciousness sides of the story of what makes them happy and feel at peace. And sometimes that is going headfirst into another church that isn't controlling, mm-hmm. but allows you to believe what you want to believe. And sometimes it's going atheist or agnostic and being like, I don't really know what's out there, but that's what works for me, because now I can actually be present instead of focusing on an afterlife. So we're always here to support whatever our guests decide, if that means not hurting anybody, not being controlled and manipulated anymore, and just allowing themselves to be who they want to be and figure out who they want to be and who they want to become. So I think that's great.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, and I think I take it for granted sometimes, but like, I did grow up 7 days a week on a church campus for 18 years, went into ministry, went into all these things. And my experience is echoed by so many people where, like, when you're in that kind of hustle and hamster wheel of religion, like, you don't even know that you need a break mm-hmm. or don't even know that this isn't normal. And I think for me, when I took a break, which now when people say, hey, I'm going to just take a break for a year and just figure out where I'm at, I'm like, you're never going back, you know, like, because you take that break and you realize, like, oh, not only did I not need this, but also I'm way better without this. And so, like, for me now, one, I don't see myself ever being religious in any way ever again. But the idea of putting myself back in a religious rat race just is so far from any vision I might have for myself that I don't see myself ever putting myself in a corporate environment that has that much control ever again. Even if it's one of the good ones, which there are, but I just, yeah, it's not for me now.
Yeah. That makes sense. That's why a lot of people during the pandemic, when they stopped going to church and they took a deep breath and looked around and like, wait, this is nice.
The stats just dive bombed. Yeah, during that
time. Yeah, everyone just kind of came back to themselves, had time with their family, realized that they were getting more out of going on a hike together than going and sitting in a church building for hours.
Yeah. I had breakfast with my kids. Oh, wow. That's so much better than rushing them to a pew.
Yeah, this is different. I'm actually interacting with them instead of telling them to be quiet and sit there.
Right.
So, yeah, that's great. And now you have your own podcast. What is your favorite thing about doing your podcast now?
I think just having these conversations. It's one of the things that when I started my podcast, I wanted to talk about religious trauma and abuse. And starting the show, I didn't think about the effect that would have on me mentally. And so it was like, I set up a Calendly link and I said, hey, if you want to share your story, like, send me, you know, sign up. And so, like, I had days I was doing 3 or 4 interviews in a row.
Eric, you cannot do that.
Yeah, you can't do that, especially with these topics.
Yeah.
That's exhausting anyway, but to do it with the topic of religious trauma and sexual abuse and physical abuse, like I was hearing some of the most harrowing stories you'd ever hear back to back to back to back. And so I was just constantly burning out. I'd take these huge breaks. I would be like, I don't know if I can do this. And about 4 months in, we moved. The pandemic was hitting, all the mental health things that come with that. My business was tanking. Like, it was just a really bad time. And so like, I would do an interview or be on the phone. I remember one day, like there's a Whole Foods near my house and I literally like pulled off and was just crying in my car. Well, this is not healthy. And so there was a lot of conversation with internally about like, do I shut this down? But also this is helping people. This is helping me at times, but hurting others. And so it just took a long time to really find a balance of like, what makes me feel best about this show? What makes me feel worst? And how do I mitigate the bad and just embrace the good? And number one was adjusting the schedule and spacing out my interviews and doing like one a day, maybe every 3 days or something. Taking walks between interviews, like taking time to decompress intentionally was huge, you know, and figuring that out. And now what I can say about the podcast is for me, you know, I mentioned that I keep going back to the default operating system. That was true of the trauma of it too. Like I used to wake up every morning with this idling buzz of just like, I grew up in this really fucked up place and it was really weird. And like, that was kind of the default just mode all the time was like, there's so much heavy shit that's just weighing me down. And now I feel like the podcast has become, I can't think of a better word than box. But box is not the right word because I don't like the idea of boxing things up and not addressing them. But it's the avenue with which I can address religious trauma in a safe, controlled space that has a time limit on it.
It's contained.
And then that's that. And then my life exists.
Right.
And so it's really cool now that like I can have these conversations. This conversation is not going to mess me up the rest of the day. It's not going to be bothering me the rest of the day. Like it's out here in a safe, controlled environment. And then I get to go live my life and have my business and my family and my all of the other amazing things. And I think being able to sever that tie to where I'm not controlled by the group I left because it's not the thing that's constantly occupying free rent in my mind is a really freeing and amazing spot. And all of that healing and all of the things I just said that are amazing came from talking to people who kind of taught me how to do that by being guests and being trauma therapists and psychologists and other survivors that can really explain and empathize with that process. And so I just love that I've been able to grow with the show. And I think you can hear it just in listening to me in episode one versus now. You can hear how much healthier I am than when I started the show. At least I hope so. I can, and I guess that's enough.
Yeah, so, that's amazing. How many episodes are you at now?
I mean, we're getting, I think it's 270 something. Wow. It's getting close to 300. So yeah, there's been a lot of talking and like, I'm at the point now where I'm like, oh, I talked about that? I don't remember that.
Yeah.
So it's definitely been, I mean, it's now hundreds of hours of conversations about this kind of stuff, which is forces you to grapple with it and heal from it. And again, talking to people who actually know what they're talking about is really helpful.
Yeah. I still learn so much from my guests about myself when they bring something up and I realize, oh my gosh, I'm that way too. And it makes sense now why. And I never put the pieces together. Like there's one that is still very in the forefront of my mind from Daniela Mastanek-Young, who left Children of God, talking about she can't do things in moderation because she grew up so strict where it was all or nothing. It's black and white. And I realized that I'm exactly the same way. If I want to go to the gym, I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to be healthy. I'm going to do all these things. If I just kind of do it loosely, I won't do it at all. But if I am doing like every single day going, I can do it for weeks at a time. And it's so interesting, the mentality of, well, I'm in it, so I have to keep going, which can be a good thing, but can also be damaging when you're doing juice cleanses for 2 months instead of just eating healthy. So it's something I've had to unwind in myself. And it all it takes is being conscious of it. Once I realized, oh, that's my personality, and I think it comes from Mormonism, which is all or nothing, now I can try and unwind that in my brain and look at things in a healthier way instead of just so black and white.
Right. And that's the thing, right, is to know that about yourself is the invaluable thing.
Yeah.
Because I think so many people leave environments where their life becomes reactionary to the environment they were in.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very much the, I wasn't allowed to wear anything but skirts. Now I'm going to go wear this, like, screw you to the church, you know, even though they don't like wearing the thing they're wearing now, it's because they can do it. Or I wasn't allowed to listen to this, I'm going to concerts, but they don't really care about music. Or, you know, I used to do this, I'm going to do this. Like, I used to, and you're still under their control. You're just living a life in reaction all the time. And I think once you understand who you are, you can start living intentionally and not out of reaction. Like, you can start taking action in your life. So, like, for me, there's things that, like, I know I enjoy that I wasn't allowed to do. There's movies I like to watch that I wouldn't have been allowed to watch. There's conversations and books and things that I like to read that I wouldn't have been allowed to read. But I know that those things also are things I like. They're not just things that are an active, like, I'm rebelling against you, you know, which is, that's a surefire way to burn out, you know? It was Josh Peck, of all people, we were interviewing a while back, and he was saying that, I think it was anger. He said, this anger and resentment, it's a powerful fuel, but it'll destroy your engine. And I think that's a really cool description, is like, I think when I was living in just a way of like, oh, screw you guys, like, yeah, you're going to go do some stuff. Your internal operating system's not any healthier.
Yeah.
And I think knowing, here's what I need, and living accordingly to that is a lot more powerful. And that starts with identifying who you are, which if you leave a fundamentalist group, you probably don't have a good grasp on for most people.
Yeah, that's such a good point, that living in rebellion is still living within the paradigm of the religion you just tried to escape, because you're still doing things within their purview of what's right and what's wrong. And now you want to do the wrong thing, but that's still within that mentality that you just tried to leave. Very interesting. Great little insight there. So with that, I need your Linda Listen moment. Sassy statement as the viral video with a toddler goes, or something further inspirational. So many good nuggets today already.
I should have saved that for this.
But you can summarize it into a sentence if you want.
Yeah. I honestly think my biggest message that's just top of mind for me lately is not to be a default fundamentalist. And I think it ties into what we just talked about, which is so many people tend to operate as if their way is the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very unfulfilling way to live. It's the same fundamentalist attitude that you see from a Richard Dawkins, that you see in a super fundamentalist pastor. And I think that while there is simplicity in the black and white, and it's easy to know, it's yes and no, and there's nothing in between, the gray is very difficult, but far more rewarding. And I think if you can have empathetic conversations with people who disagree and find your truth somewhere in the middle of all of these rigid systems, you're going to live a far more fulfilling, not easy, but a far more fulfilling life altogether.
I agree. Amazing. Great job. Thanks for coming on and chatting with me. It's been so nice having this conversation. And I'm looking forward to, after this, we're going to do an interview for your channel, your podcast. So guys, these are supposed to be, if all the stars align, released at the exact same time. So after you're finished watching this, you can go over to Eric's channel at Preacher Boys on YouTube and find the interview there with me, and vice versa. If you just came over from Eric's channel, hey, what's up? I'm Shalise with Cults of Consciousness. Thanks for coming by. Do you have any other final thoughts before we go?
No, I don't. I'm going to keep that one a solid no.
All right. And you're on Instagram at preacherboysdoc, right?
Yep. And if you haven't already, go to HBO or Max, I guess is called. Nobody calls it that. Go to HBO Max and check out Let Us Pray if you want to get a glimpse of the IFB movement in a very cinematic, cool way. If you want the casual, chatty way, the Preacher Boys podcast.
Yeah, that documentary was very eye-opening and it's pretty heavy. So just a little warning there as well. But this has been awesome. Thank you again for joining us. Guys, if you like this episode or you have comments, anything you want to leave below. We love seeing your reactions and your thoughts and your words of encouragement for our guests. They do read the comments. It means a lot when you can leave them a little something. And if you want to support the podcast, you can get some of our merch at coalstoconsciousness.com under the merch tab. You can become a patron at patreon.com/coalstoconsciousness. Our newest patrons, Gabby and Donald, thank you so much for your support. If you want to come to Costa Rica with us and do something not culty, we have 6 spots left as of today, and we're really excited. That's going to be at the end of August. I'm just going to go hang out, relax, and do some adventurous things together. So if you want to do that, you can find that in the description. And if you like this video, I will leave 2 more down here below that you can check out. And until next time, follow your highest excitement, be conscious, and be well. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, it would mean a lot if you could like and subscribe on YouTube and leave a review or a comment to help with our visibility. You can also find me on social media at cults2consciousness or reach out by email at cults2consciousness@gmail.com.